is University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you a second conversation with the Reverend Dr. W. Wilson Good, Sr., director of AMACHI, a program providing help for children of incarcerated parents, former mayor of Philadelphia, a preacher, a man of many experiences and activities. Welcome back, Dr. Good.
Thank you so much. I'm very, very pleased to be back.
Well, I'm glad that you agreed to have a second conversation. And, you know, in our last program, we talked about AMACHI, a program that you founded it that has reached some 30,000 youngsters. But today, we're going to concentrate on your earlier life. I know AMACHI is much a part of it now and probably always will be in the future. But let's talk a little bit more about you. Where, by the way, were you born?
I was born in a small town called Seaboard, North Carolina. I was born on a farm on Jordan Mill Pond Road. And by the way, the house still exists that I was born in. It's now a one-room house on a piece of ground. And every year I go back to look at that house to remind me where I started out in life. It's in Seaboard, North Carolina. I was born there and one of seven children to my mother and father who were sharecroppers. My father deceased in 1987 and my mother deceased in 1989. My father at 84 and my mother at 96 years of age. They had good genes and I have seven of us and the oldest is 76 and the youngest is 66 today.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, well, now, how long did you stay in North Carolina?
I left there when I was 15 years of age in 1954. I left to move here to the city.
So you had a chance to oversee what was happening as a sharecropper's life?
I actually recall very vividly. I worked in the field from the time I was 6 years of age until I was 15. So that's 9 years working in the field and 9 years of sharecropping, 9 years of picking cotton, of, as I'd say, shaking peanuts and pulling tobacco, 9 years of living in the rural segregated South, with all of the things you read about very much apparent, a separate water fountain, separate schools, no buses for black students to go to school. When you went to a store, you had to get out of line and let someone else come in. And if someone white came in, you had to get out of line. If you walked down the street on the sidewalk and someone white came along, you had to remove yourself to the gutter. So it was the rural South. Going to the movie in the balcony of the theater. So all of that was my early life until I was 15 years of age. And I basically lived there until I was 15 and moved to Philadelphia when I was 15 years of age.
One observation, sharecropping itself, what was the relationship of the sharecropper to the person who owned the properties?
It was a business arrangement. The owner of the land would get a family that would come and work the land for a 80-20 split. 80 cents of a dollar earned on the land went to the landlord. 20 cents went to the operator of the land, the farmers. And so we were able to live on the farm in a house that was free, but we had to buy our own food and live off of 20% of what we earned. We were able to own a farm to have a garden and to grow tomatoes and cucumbers and things that helped us, chicken, raise chicken. So there were many things that we could do to help us to eat, but it was 20 cents out of a dollar that we got on a farm in terms of raising the crops on a farm. And it was one step removed from slavery. It was basically the people who did not have anywhere to go after slavery simply went back to the same slave owners who owned the land and worked in what I call a semi-slavery system. And I was a part of that for 9 years of working. 15 years of my life I spent in that environment, and until I moved in 1954 to this city in Philadelphia.
And why did you move?
We moved primarily because my father was in prison at the time. We moved while he was still in prison. And we moved primarily because it was the beginning of the industrialization of the South, where working a farm was really not going to produce much in the future, because many of the landlords now had bought industrial equipment where they could pick cotton and do tobacco all much quicker than you could by hand. So the laboring part of raising the crops was disappearing. That was one. Two was that it was difficult for my mother, without my father being there, and just four boys, because my sisters had moved away. My oldest brother was in the Army at the time. It was just difficult for the five of us to maintain a farm and to keep a farm going. And so it was time to go. It was time to move on for those reasons. And we moved to the big city of Philadelphia.
What happened to your father after prison?
My father reunited with the family in Philadelphia in 1956, and he had had a major drinking problem. That was the reason that he had actually ended up in jail in the first place. And when he was drinking, he became very violent. And he came and reunited in 1956 and never drank again, and lived with my mother and the family until he deceased in 1987. So after that, that was a very, very wholesome and productive life.
Mm. Now, after you got to Philadelphia, you started school or got into your own studies here? Because I imagine you weren't getting much down there in North Carolina at the time.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is that in the South, we went to school in the summertime. And harvest in the fall.
Okay.
And planted in the spring. So it was winter, summer type of school in order to accommodate the farmers. So they had a schedule that met our needs in terms of farming at that time. But my experience with school was one of a nurturing one. The teachers cared about whether or not we learned. They spent time, extra time if necessary. They took us aside. They helped us. They nurtured us. They tutored us. They cared. They would come to our houses if they needed to help us. They would come and talk with our parents if they needed to. And keep in mind, we're not talking about a 1,000 pupil school district. We're talking about a few hundred at the most, probably less than 100 in some cases. And in fact, the first school I attended there, there were all six grades in one room with a one-room schoolhouse, and all of the students in the sixth grades were all in one room. And we had three teachers teaching sixth grades. And so I felt as if I got what I needed, nothing like nearly what they have today, but I got what I needed at that time.
So the sharecropping, the fields, did not really stop you from getting that part of your work?
No. And I was able to come here and to pick up where I left off in the South. Mm-hmm. And the difference was, there I was encouraged, here I was discouraged.
Mm-hmm. Because even with what may have been more here, it was less of the nurturing.
Less of the nurturing and less of a desire to have me be all that I could become.
What do you ascribe that to? In the South, your teachers were black, I imagine.
In the South, the teachers were black. Yes. In here, they were white. And basically, they just simply I think I will not use the word racism, although it may have been. I think it was culture. I think they just simply did not understand that African-American students could learn and be all that any other student could be. And therefore, if they invested in them, they could soar and they could achieve beyond anything that we could imagine.
But teachers are supposed to know enough about culture so that that doesn't intervene in the process. So one might think about that other word, racism.
We probably would hope that teachers would know enough about culture. I don't think at that time they were teaching enough about culture.
True, true. But you survived here not because you were encouraged, but because you had certain kinds of mentoring processes taking place with you.
I had a mother who believed in me and a father who believed in me, and I had older brothers and sisters who believed in me, and they will always say that if no one else in this family makes it, Wilson is going to make it. And I had a cousin, and she's just a sweet lady who name was Frances Jean Martin, who said to me when I was 11 years old in the South, she said, Willie Wilson Good, my whole name, Willie Wilson Good, you're going to be something one day. I'm telling you now, you're going to be something one day. And I never forgot the fact that she was in the cotton field. She looked at me and said, you do not have to pick cotton. You will not have to pick cotton when you grow up. You're going to be something important one day. And I have not seen her in about 25 years. And she lives in New Jersey. I intend to find out where she lives and go and talk with her and thank her for those words of encouragement at 11 years of age that I never forgot in my life. Never forgot them. Never forgot the passion and the fact that she said it with so much confidence. Mm-hmm. So much confidence.
What it can mean for a single person, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and what an impact that single person, mm-hmm, can, mm-hmm, have on a single child, which is much of what you've talked, mm-hmm, about in Amachi, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're listening to University Forum. My guest, the Reverend Dr. W. Wilson Good, Sr. Dr. Good, the first W. What does it really stand
for? It stands, I tell people who ask me that question, it stands for wonderful. but I will tell you the truth. They stand for Willie. My family named me Willie Wilson Good. And they named me Willie Wilson Good because my understanding is my mother wanted to name me Wilson and my father wanted to name me Willie. And they compromised and named me Willie Wilson Good. And so people ask the second question, why did you drop Willie? And not because I did not like Willie, because my family never called me Willie. My family, from the very day that I can remember it being called me Wilson.
And if Mother wanted you at some time, I'm sure she said that, Wilson.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, after you got through doing some schooling in the Philadelphia school system, because this is where you were, correct? In Philadelphia.
Yes, yes.
How did you get on to Morgan? That's a great university. In fact, I think you wear a watch. Don't you wear a special watch that has something to do with Morgan University?
Morgan State University Hall of Fame.
Uh-huh.
Wonderful, wonderful honor I received from Morgan State University. I ended up in Morgan that even though my high school counselor told me never to think about going to college, and her name was Mrs. Frances Flanagan. We'll never forget her name at John Bartram High School. Frances Flanagan, a counselor at John Bartram High School, who tried to convince me in 1954 to go to the industrial arts course because I was from the farm and therefore I could use my hands. I could not, by the way. And then when I demonstrated I could be a good academic student, convinced me not to go to school. I ended up working in the vodka factory, as I've said before, for some 8 months. And it was my pastor and his wife at a very critical point in my life who became my big brother and big sister, who nurtured me and sent me off to Morgan State University. And I never looked back.
Well, Morgan State University, I hear about it all the time. I sit on a board that's chaired by a Morgan State person, John Griswold of Children's Service Incorporated, and some other Morgan State. So I hear about Morgan all the time. Great school, very great school indeed. But now, at Morgan, you studied what?
I was a history major, a major in history, and I because I wanted to be a history teacher. I wanted to be a history teacher, and my desire was to be a history teacher. And I graduated from Morgan with a degree, with a major in history and a minor in political science. And I ended up with a scholarship, a fellowship to the University of Wisconsin, which I did not take. I elected to go into the Army. I had a commission. I was married, and my wife was expecting our first child, and so I went in the Army, and my first daughter was born in 1961, in December of 1961. And so I was able to, in 1961, to be the father of my first child. I was also in the U.S. Army in Colorado Springs in 1961. So that's basically is my story.
You didn't stay a commissioned person in the Army, though you left at some point and went on into Wharton. When did you get to Wharton?
Well, I actually, interesting enough, I left the Army after 2 years, and two wonderful years that had me grow up. I went in the Army when I was 21, left when I was 23 years of age, and as an officer in the Army. Left and came back, and for a very short period of time became a probation officer. And then for another short period of time, perhaps a couple of years, became work for a maintenance company in West Philadelphia as a manager, Milton Clarkey's maintenance company. Clarkey's maintenance company. And then worked for Allstate Insurance Company as a claim adjuster. And then went to work for the Philadelphia Council for Community Advancement, PCCA,
yes.
Where I stayed for 12 wonderful years, from going there as someone who was just a community activist and ended up becoming this president by the time I left 12 years later, and just had a wonderful time of building houses and helping rebuild communities in that time frame. And while I was there, the Governor Shapp called me at the end of that tenure and simply asked me whether or not I wanted to be a member of the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission. I said, wow. I said, what is it? within a matter of months, I was a member of that, the first African-American member of the commission.
Regulating
$7 billion in utilities across the Commonwealth. And then in 6 months, I was chair.
Chair, that's right.
Chair.
You were well on your way.
I'm looking back, and in a matter of some 7-8 months, I'd gone from running this neighborhood, building houses, to regulating $7 billion in utilities now to the chair of that commission for the whole Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
And moving right along then to the next, was it the managing director?
And interesting, Dr. Moore, what happened on that was after I was there for about 18 months, I was reading the paper and saw my name in the paper as being the leading candidate for the next managing director of the city. And I really was shocked that my name.
You had to read the paper to find out.
I read the newspaper.
Is that right?
No one had ever talked with me about it. I read the newspaper. And then after I read the newspaper, Mayor Green did talk with me, but not about anything specific. Just talk with me, and it was not until the end of November that I have a conversation with Bill Green about the job of managing director, and was appointed as the first African American managing director of the city. May I confess something there?
What's that, sir?
And my confession is that the job that I always wanted in the city was not to be mayor, but was to be managing director.
So you had it, which meant that the next step had to be the mayor.
I would have been happy to be managing director for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful job, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. And was disappointed but excited that when Bill Green said he was not running again, and that I had an opportunity to run and become the first African-American mayor of the city of Philadelphia.
And you were mayor for two terms, in which you had some great highlights and, of course, another not so high.
I'm seldom asked anymore about that. But yes, I had some tremendous highlights. I mean, I think that the opportunity really to be able to level the playing field for women and minorities in government, to break down the barriers against contracts for minorities and women, to be able to really say with pride, this is my skyline, that the skyline, which is a city, seven buildings built above the Hattie William Penn.
I remember old Willie Penn.
All of that happened on my tenure. And then people, rightly so, talk about MOVE. And what I said to them is that MOVE was an exception to a life that I had lived, that it was some bad decision making that took place on that day, and as the chief executive officer of the city, that I'm responsible for when people make bad decisions and bad things happen as a result of it.
And there were other people in that administration. You had a managing director at that time.
Oh yes, and Leo Brooks and Gregor Sambor and Bill Fish. Bill Richmond,
fire department,
yeah. all were people who were professional, who knew their jobs to do. But
the buck stops with the mayor.
Dr. Moore, in the end, if you're going to take credit for the good things that happen, you also have to take responsibility when bad things happen. You can't have it both ways. You can't go out and say, I'm only going to take credit for the good things. And then when something bad happens, just kind of run away from it and blame other people.
Has the healing process come about now? What finally gave some healing to the city and to the community?
I'm not sure. I think that, number one, that that the healing took place over time. And I think as people began to put it in perspective, they saw it as one event in the city that was just a tragic mistake that took place. But the thing I would add is that I have, in the last 3 years, traveled to 40 different states, over 100 different cities, and the issue of MOVE has never been raised. The question has never come up. Outside of Philadelphia, and that people recognize me as a former mayor of the city, and recognize the positive things that I did for the city when I was in office, and I accept all of it. I accept the low points and the high points. But what I will not ever accept is someone trying to define me by the low point.
As you moved out of the mayoralty with moving on, you became a minister.
Yes.
Of course, you had another job, I think, with the United States Department of Education.
Yeah,
you can't
yeah.
hit all those. But with the few minutes we have left, talk a little bit about your ministry and what that's meant to you.
Well, I felt a calling to the ministry when I was 28 years of age. And it was 30 years later that I answered the call. I felt a pulling to that. And I felt God calling me to be one of his spokespersons. And I ended up deciding that if I was going to be a qualified spokesperson, I needed seminary. So I went back to Eastern Baptist Seminary for some 4 years, got a doctorate of ministry, and then have actually since that time given an average of 50 sermons per year for the last 10 years.
That's more than some full-time pastors do.
Yeah, 50 sermons a year for the last 10 years, and I've spoken to more than 250 different churches in that time, and spoken to national conferences all across this country in that time. I feel, Dr. Moore, I'm at the happiest point of my life. With the Marchi program, I feel joy. With my preaching, I feel joy. With my relationship with God, I feel joy. My relationship with my wife, 46 years, and my family and my children, I feel joy. I'm at a happy point in my life where I feel that at age 68, the things are lining up in a way I would want them to in the seasoned years of my life.
And as an elder statesman, really, you bring so much to those who are here to listen to you and to understand all that you have done and all that you've accomplished. Because in your seasoning, you have helped to season the lives of many others.
And I hope to do a lot more in the process.
Well, what is next for the Reverend Doctor?
The remaining part of my life will be spent on trying to rescue as many children of prisoners that I can rescue. I can't imagine doing anything else other than spending the remaining part of my productive life and simply trying to speak for those children who don't have voice to speak for themselves, give a face to them because they're not able to have that face appear, and to be able to advocate for their interests in every place of power that I can advocate for them.
The Reverend Dr. W. Wilson Good, Sr., a man of many actions, now providing a strong interventive program through the Amachi for children of incarcerated parents, an elder statesman with many, many more years to come. Thank you for being my guest on University Forum.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you.
I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email, jemoore@wrti.org, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4376.